right. We're sitting here with Bill from Zevoid Games, Eric and I. Bill, thank you for joining RP Grinders today. How are you?
I'm doing good. Just busy as always, working on Cosmic Star Heroine.
We're definitely going to talk about Cosmic Star Heroine in a bit. I'm excited for the game. I know Eric is super excited. This is coming on the heels of just kind of a three-pack of great games: Cthulhu Saves the World, Breath of Death 7, Precipice of Darkness 3 and 4. It's been quite a ride for you, Bill.
Yeah, it has. My life has changed a lot in the past 4 or 5 years. Once we started doing game development, me and Robert, and started up Zevoid Games, I mean, I can go into it later if you want, but, you know, it started out as a small thing. I was actually in law school at the time, and then Breath of Death did really well on Xbox, and then Cthulhu Saves the World became our most popular product, and things just got bigger and better since then.
Well, let's talk about your career in law, or your non-career in law, as it were. I see in your bio it's kind of helped you during this process. Why did you decide to get into video games as opposed to a life of law and just a bunch of boring BS that nobody cares about?
Doesn't that answer the question right there? But I've always really had a lot of fun making computer stuff, especially when it comes to video games. Mm-hmm. Me and my brothers taught ourselves QBasic programming when we were in middle school, and a lot of our peers did too, just for fun. And after that, I did a lot of mods for first-person shooters, like for Doom and Doom 2 and Duke Nukem 3D, and then Unreal and Unreal Tournament. And it's always been just this incredibly rewarding hobby for me. So I never really thought it would be a good career choice, just because at the time I was choosing a major for college. I didn't want to do computer science because the dot bomb had just happened. And I was afraid that was, you know, going to be hard to find a job. So I went to do mechanical engineering because, I mean, that's a great major, because you can go into a lot of things. And then I decided to do law because I thought, I can do research and writing. That sounds fun. But halfway through law school, I just had to start making games again. And I made a game for fun and released it for free as a remake of an Atari 2600 game called Adventure.
Yes.
And after that I didn't publicize it or anything, but a lot of people were intrigued by it. And me and Robert knew each other from the Penny Arcade forums. So we decided to work together to release the Xbox game Breath of Death 7. But again, I was still in law school. I wasn't sure if this was going to be a big thing in the long term. So I finished law school with this idea that I would do patent law, or intellectual property, so copyrights, patents, trademarks. Sure. And I studied and focused on that real hard. And then we released Cthulhu Saves the World while I was taking a bar exam, which was a lot of fun.
How did you manage that?
On Steam, and around that time, those two games came out on Steam. Penny Arcade contacted us to do a game with them. So I was working at a job, my first job as a lawyer, and I hit this crossroads where I had to do one or the other. I couldn't do both.
Right.
And at the time, law was just, it's not terribly boring, but it's not really exciting, especially when you're new to it. And I can't say it's terrible. It's just, it's tons of work, and it can be really stressful.
You can be completely honest on this show. It's terrible. I was a political science major, and I kind of felt the same way. And now I'm podcasting, and you're making great games.
Awesome. So that's what happened. It was a crossroads, and I had to choose one or the other. And I figured, I don't have anything to lose. You never get an opportunity like this more than once a year. Once in your lifetime to go and make games full time and have it be successful. So it was a once in a lifetime opportunity versus, you know, I can always go back to law if I need to. But so far it's going really well, and me and Robert seem to be on the same page about the business, about the games we do, and, you know, how we go about things. So it's been working out really well.
It has to be kind of a a tough mixture, mixing business and pleasure that way, right? I mean, you have to make certain business decisions that you may not like that would help out in the creative side of things and vice versa, right?
Yeah, a big thing. Well, what it really boils down to for most developers, especially indie developers, but the big studios as well, you have to balance how much time and resources you have versus the feature set and quality of the game. Like, you know, you want to make every game you can as best you can.
Right.
But sometimes all the features and side quests and submissions and bonus, you know, adventures and stuff like that, you just don't, you run out of time or resources before you really can realistically implement all of those things. So you have to choose the best scope and the best quality you can for your given time or budget or resources. So that's really what the balance is.
Right. And at some point you have to decide this is a release date and we have to make this release date, right? I mean, you can't just sit there, you know, oh, I've got, you know, 5 more dungeons I'd like to add to this game and then delay the inevitable, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's not always as simple as that.
Right.
You know, it's sometimes it's not just, can I add 5 more dungeons and I want to hit this release date, because sometimes release dates are a little bit flexible and sometimes features can be partially implemented so that they're really fun. They're just not what you had in mind, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, that's really what I think most developers run into. And some developers, if they're doing it just as a hobby and they have a full-time job, they can take, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years on it and it's no big deal and make the game they want. But if you're doing it full-time, you know, unless your first game was just a mega hit, then you really got to choose how much time, features, and resources you want to put into it.
You know, I always wondered about that. Every gamer's dream is to get into the industry and make a bunch of money and you know, have fun while you're doing it. And there are success cases like yours and a lot of others out there, but it's not easy. You know,
No, it's not. It's an extremely competitive business and market.
Well, talk about that. Do you have to have a lucky break in a way, or do you just have to be very good at what you do, or a combination of all those things and more?
Probably a combination.
Yeah.
I will say that luck is definitely involved. A lot of timing is sort of timing, I think, is a big luck issue. For example, we released our first games on Xbox Live Indie Games while that platform was still kind of new and it didn't have a bad reputation and there weren't many competing RPGs, so we got a lot of limelight for that genre on there. And then when we went to Steam, it was before Steam kind of got a whole bunch of overhauls to it. So it was when Steam, you know, you still got a huge amount of exposure on the front page just for releasing. And those are things that are outside of anyone's control. You know, it was a matter of luck on that timing. But there are things you can do to help yourself, you know, kind of succeed or at least increase your chances of succeeding. And I think to kind of put them in a nutshell, my opinion on it is that be as creative as you can and do the best job you can within your own abilities. Don't overreach where you just can't do it. Make the best thing you possibly can that you can actually execute well. I see a lot of very ambitious indie games, especially on Xbox Live indie games before, where it was very clear that they had this vision for something that was on par with an arcade game or a big studio game, and they just couldn't pull it together with a small team of resources. The other really important thing I would say is to find a target, find a little niche that you can appeal to and hit it really hard. So I think a lot of developers try to hit the market at large. They want to make the next Flappy Bird.
Right.
They want to make a game that sells to 100 million people or whatever. You can try for that, and if you strike gold or whatever, you'll be, you know, you could, there's like a, it's like winning the lottery. You might be able to do that, but there's so much competition, it's insane. The route we took is a much more, I think, conservative route, which is pick a target market that's not served as well as maybe it could be, and do something as unique as possible to stand out in that market, mm-hmm. and then just support that market as best you can. Look. So ours is, you know, kind of a small little target within the RPG, you know, the JRPG genre.
Mm-hmm.
And we just try to hit that market and make the best games we can with our resources for that. And it's worked out for us.
You know, in a big way, for sure. Your games are great. No question about it. We'll get to the games in just a second. Let's speak to that a little bit. You know, first of all, why 8-bit, right?
Uh-huh.
And also, why the JRPG market, which seems to be, I'm not to say dwindling here in the United uh-huh. States, but there isn't a huge market for JRPGs here.
Well, to the first question, why 8-bit, why 16-bit? And the answer is because we feel like that style, I guess, it's got kind of a long-term appeal. It came about in the, you know, with the original consoles that had limited color palettes and limited mm-hmm. resolutions. But there's something that's very clean and colorful and expressive about 8 or 16-bit sprites that you may or may not get with. You can definitely get with higher resolutions,
mm-hmm.
but there's something really appealing about them. And I've noticed that, you know, the older groups, the older demographics, like the 20, 30, 40-year-olds, there's a nostalgia factor there, which is fine, and they enjoy that art because they remember it. Mm-hmm. But I've also noticed that kids like it too. We've brought our games to things like PAX and other little expos, and you would think, oh, kids, you know, they want to see high-fidelity graphics like on their PS4. Mm-hmm. No, they love it. It's colorful, and it's bright, and lines are bold, and contrast is usually bold. So I think it's a very appealing visual look, even though it's sort of, you know, based around outdated hardware's limitations at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it's a lot easier for one artist asset guy to make an 8 or 16-bit game than it is to do a full HD fluidly animated game.
Right.
So there's a bang for your buck on that too.
Are there plans in the future to maybe go in that direction, a la maybe do a 3D game like Final Fantasy VII or right. something like that?
I'm going to say no, because that's not something we see ourselves doing, at least not anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to say no forever and ever, but realistically, probably not. Also, I don't know if, you know, that sort of blocky, chunky PS1 style of 3D really aged that well.
Right.
Right? As not as much as maybe the 16-bit look did.
Right.
But, you know, there's probably ways to do it realistically that aren't too bad. So
mm-hmm.
I won't close that door forever and ever, but realistically, I'm going to say no.
I can hear the Final Fantasy VII fan base let out a collective gasp.
Well, I mean, it's a good game. It's a classic game. And, you know, people debate about Final Fantasy VII versus Final Fantasy VI mm-hmm. or whatever.
I'm one of those, by the way. I'm more of a VI guy than a VII. But I know I'm probably in the minority.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's fair. You can see the pros and cons of both games.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, Final Fantasy VII, it didn't age that bad. And I say that just because it had pre-rendered backgrounds. So mm-hmm. we're not looking at that whole PS1 era of, you know, fog to hide the draw distance with the blurry yeah. texture look. It's a clean 3D generated backdrop with cute little chibi characters running around on it. So it's not bad.
Right. You guys kind of, I mean, getting back to the JRPG part.
Oh, of
the
yeah. question, you asked about that genre being, you said, dwindling or something like that.
Right.
You guys,
well, it was kind of a leap of faith, in my opinion, to uh-huh. like go after that segment. Right. I mean, I personally believe that the JRPG market here in the United States is still there. They're just mm-hmm. kind of hibernating in a way. And you guys right. kind of brought that out in people.
Yeah. Here's the thing. With the last generation of consoles, the PS3 and 360, the additional, you know, processing and graphics power that these machines had made it very, made it a huge requirement to increase your team and your budgets for your games to produce a game for that from the big studios. Mm-hmm. And the JRPG genre kind of narrowed down a little bit, became a little bit more niche. So it became too risky for a lot of the RPG developers for consoles to release a game on there. A lot of the ones you saw on the PS2 throughout its life just almost never showed up on PS3 or Xbox 360, with a few exceptions, until the end of the life cycle. Mm-hmm. A lot of them went to the PSP or the 3D, the PSP or the Nintendo DS. And because of that, you know, all you really had was like Final Fantasy 13 or Blue Dragon or Lost Odyssey and a few others. And it felt like that genre was dwindling because of that, I think. You didn't see as many big budget, you know, spectacle JRPGs on there. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the market went away. I just think it kind of became, it didn't, it's not big enough for these big development studios and publishers to be worth their, you know, their big return on investment they need to put into it. Until now, now that the PS3 development has gotten less expensive, the install base is larger, and that's why we're seeing stuff like, you know, the games that have been more recently released on the PS3, like Ni No Kuni, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we chased it because of that. There's still right. a market there. It's just not being served by the big publishers anymore, which is a perfect opening for a small developer to come in and serve that market. And yeah, we're not going to release something that looks like Final Fantasy 13, but if we can make something that looks appealing at least and plays really well and is a good value, mm-hmm. then our belief was that there'd be enough people that would go for that to support a two-person development studio. Yeah. And so far, that's pretty much how it's worked out.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, kind of changing gears just a little bit, Kickstarter's been huge in the development of your games over there mm-hmm. at Zeboid or Zeboid. How do you pronounce it? Zeboid or Zeboid? I get varying things.
It's Zeboid. I mean, either one's fine, but okay. Zeboid, yeah. I know, it's like the Zeb part, but yeah.
Right. Why Kickstarter? I've been railing against Kickstarter mm-hmm. in most cases. I know there are a few people that kind of use it in the right way, and I think you guys happen to be one of the few. Uh-huh. Not just to save my own ass in this interview, but...
No, it's okay. We know a lot of people that think Kickstarter is blah.
It's not potato salad is what he's saying.
Well, I just think that it's just used wrong in most cases. Uh-huh. But in you guys' case, you guys have used Kickstarter to great effect. Hmm.
There's a huge debate about what Kickstarter, you know, should be used for or how it should be used. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for us, we wanted to use it as an opportunity to make something we don't think we could have made any other way, or at least not easily. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to do it in a way that hopefully fans and people that like JRPGs would be interested in without feeling like it was, you know, exploitative, like some Kickstarters appear to be.
Right.
It was also a good way to do stuff that we've always kind of wanted to do. Just as an example, I've always wanted to do an art book for our games. Mm-hmm. And now is a really good time to do that, because this is the first game that it's kind of we've been totally on our own with since Cthulhu Saves the World. You know, we did the Penny Arcade games, and that involves the Penny Arcade IP. Mm-hmm. So for us, it was a way to come back to a completely independent, you know, idea and game development, and give people that wanted to sort of see behind the scenes and maybe be involved a little bit through Kickstarter. It's just a way to do that, but then also to fund certain things that we need for this game to happen and give us the time to work on it. So that's how we saw it, and that's how we went about it. Definitely there's a huge conversation to be had about how Kickstarter ought to be used. Is it only for brand new studios or new projects, or is it exploitative of large studios with a long history to use it that already have, you know, maybe they already have a big, you know, budget stocked up, or should it only be for, you know, small, the little guys mm-hmm. or what? But as far as us, we just went the way we thought would be something fans would appreciate and that right. we could actually get something out of.
Well, I honestly think that you guys did it the right way. I wouldn't have bought your, you know, Breath of Death 7 if I didn't feel comfortable with the way that you guys, you know, went about that. But one thing that I always, and we'll get off the Kickstarter kick here in a minute. one thing that I always hated about Kickstarter is when people ask about, you know, the money beyond what you guys get, nobody ever gives me a straight answer.
Oh, right.
With what happens with the money after it reaches all your stretch goals and, you know, and it just goes way above and beyond. Like,
right.
One of them that I can think of offhand was the game by Double Fine. That,
yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, what did they do with the rest of that money? You know, that's the only issue that I really had with it is once it goes way beyond the stretch.
Despite the amount of money they got, they couldn't make the game they wanted exactly. So they had to split in two.
Right. And actually you can find out, I think Tim Schafer, he's pretty open about what they did and how, where that went and stuff. Mm-hmm. You could probably tweet him and find out for that matter.
Right. It was just an example. I don't mean to throw Double Fine under the bus, but there's been quite a few like that where I'm like, well, you know.
Well, so, you know, for us, we just wanted to set a goal that we needed to make the game. And we kind of said during the Kickstarter that if we go over, we're just going to put that back into the game. You know, it was a little bit flexible, but we didn't want to do the whole stretch goal thing because – honestly, in our opinion, stretch goals can be awesome, especially for increasing funding. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to blow up the scope of our game before it was even started. You know what I mean?
Right.
We decided on the goal and the scope of the game, and we wanted to do that. And we didn't want to create a graduated system of how big or how small the game was going to be, just depending on the funding of the Kickstarter.
Yeah, you guys didn't want to overpromise and underdeliver. You know, and that's the right way of doing things for sure.
Yeah, and hopefully that's what, you know, people understood when they saw it. Right. That was our intent.
I got one more kind of big hitting topic in the world of games now, and it involves Gamergate. Uh-huh. What are your thoughts on Gamergate? Like, I know your games aren't in that type of vein. When people talk about sexualizing women and all that stuff, but you have to have an opinion on it. So I'm asking the question, what do you think about Gamergate?
Well, the thing that I've noticed about Gamergate is that there seems to be a lot of people with a lot of different ideas about what it should be. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for people to respond to it just because they don't know who is going to, you know, feel like they're being spoken to. Is it, you know, there's people that want to target that believe it's about just about ethics and journalism, and then there's people that think it's just about, or that it's also about you know, women in the industry, and there's people that think it's just about what was the other thing, about journalists trying to use their websites as a platform for social agendas and things like that. So, I mean, to me, it's kind of like, how do you, it's kind of, it would, to me, it would be almost like asking a political opinion question like this, like, how would you respond to the, you know, the conservative opinion of society or the liberal opinion of society? And it's like, oh gosh, well, I mean, there's so much in there and it's sort of, and it's almost loaded. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know if I answered your question or not. Well, but I think it would be better served if it was a more focused movement, if you want to call it a movement. I guess that's my opinion on it.
I guess to reframe the question just a little bit, is it more of a societal issue or is it a gaming issue?
Oh, that's hard to say. The whole thing with so if you're going to go with that it's about journalistic ethics, that's a debate that's been going on for thousands of years probably. I mean, or at least since journalism existed, you know what I mean?
Right.
It really has. I mean, even this country and there's countries around the world that still battle with what counts as journalistic, what's ethics for journalists, and what counts as, you know, what's what goes beyond journal the ethics of a journalist and what they can do. Mm-hmm. If you're going at it from the question of, is the industry growing? Is it changing? Is the demographics changing? I think that is a little bit unique to this industry, just because this industry is still fairly new. Mm-hmm. I bet that the comic book industry, or let's go with that. The comic book industry would probably have a similar evolution if it had started more recently than it did. It started, mm-hmm. 100 plus years ago or so, 100 mm-hmm. years ago?
Yeah.
If it had started 30 or 40 years ago, it would probably be seeing a similar, I want to call it growing pains.
Right.
But since it's older, it's probably went through that growing and that changing phase before, you know, the big Twitter, the Twitter revolution began. And I mean our interconnectivity and social media wasn't as big, or didn't exist when comic books, for example, went through that growing phase. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's a little bit both. If you look at it from the ethics side, ethics is an ongoing question. But for a young industry like ours, you know, things are always changing. And so just because it's still fairly new, I think that has a lot to do with what we're seeing.
Right. I also think the minority is not speaking for the majority. I don't think the majority of game developers and game journalists and the like feel the way that the minority feel about women in the industry. There's always going to be those boneheaded people that think that women have their place in the world. You know, they should be behind the man, that et cetera, which is, in my opinion, very archaic and whatnot. But let's move on to your games. Let's talk about some fun stuff. Breath of Death 7. I want to speak specifically about that because I have played Breath of Death 7. Mm-hmm. It's such a love letter to JRPGs. I think the passion that you guys brought into that game, and obviously Cthulhu Saves the World as well. It's just such a joyous game. It may not be the best game ever out there, but it's fun, so fun to play and see some of the in references to JRPGs. I just can't thank you enough for doing that. Not a lot of people are doing that these days. Our show RP Grinders is all about JRPGs for the most part. And, first, you know, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Might I
thank
say
you for
it's
playing
a,
it.
Yeah, it's a breath of fresh air. <you know? laughs> But you guys, I mean, how did you pack so much into something so small? You know what I mean? Like, it's just one game in the vast sea of games out there. But you guys have packed so many in references and comedy and just a lot of great stuff in that game. How did you guys put it all together?
Well, when we made it, the idea behind Breath of Death 7 was to make something kind of a compact version of an RPG. We wanted everything to move very quickly and not allow the game to last, you know, we didn't want it to last more than 4 hours or 5 hours. And so we structured it around that. But as we were doing that, we just had all of these ideas, and there was all these things that have inspired us. And, you know, at the time it was our first game, we weren't sure, you know, there's no guarantee that we were going to be able to do it again, or at least you do it again in the same way. So it was kind of like our attempt to make something that we could pour all this stuff in that we've always loved. And We wanted to put in little silly stuff, silly references to other games that we loved, and we wanted to put in, you know, things that other RPG gamers would understand, because, I mean, we love that stuff, and it was our first game. We were just too excited not to put all that in there, and so we were able to kind of cram it into our little streamlined RPG just because we wanted to, and at the time, who knew if we were going to be able to do another game like that again afterwards? Yeah. Was it going to succeed or not? You know, we didn't know. So it really was just kind of us pouring our hearts into this little thing. And it is a little game. It's a little game. It's very, I think it's very, what do you call it? Very modest, because it's, you know, it's not pretty and it's kind of short, and the simple battle, the battle presentation is like a black screen and stuff. But, you know, for us, it was just this exciting thing. And finally release a game on a console too is also very exciting. So I think that it was just a combination of those factors.
You know, there's another theme that I wanted to talk about in your games to you. You have a lot of references to werewolves and vampires and skeletons and Cthulhu. Yeah. You guys must be horror fans as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Robert, you know, my partner, is the horror genre is probably his very close second favorite genre behind JRPGs or RPGs in general. Mm-hmm. Well, I take that back. He's also a huge fan of Tower Defense. But, you know, there's some Tower Defense RPGs, which are awesome, and we would totally do that. But we like JRPGs, and we're going to keep making them.
Awesome.
So he's a big fan. I really enjoy the horror genre and horror movies and horror I really like horror themes. I haven't played as many horror games just because I just never knew. I was never really drawn to the ones that are popular that I knew about. And I'm starting to get into them more now, especially since there's a little bit of a resurgence of them. But, you know, the obvious ones like Resident Evil 1 and 2 and 4 and, you know, Silent Hills and stuff, I've played those and those are great. But, you know, I want to get into some of the newer ones, like, you know, I want to try out Amnesia and, you know, the Evil Within just came out, I think, today. Yeah. And, you know, it's a great genre. But I really love the theme of... not just zombies. That was a big meme on Xbox Live indie games. If you put zombies in your game, people are going to buy it. If you can shoot zombies, people love that crap.
Right.
Well, I mean, we had zombies in Breath of Death, but that wasn't the main theme. The main theme was just the horror, the horror elements. And same with Cthulhu Saves the World, which is the eldritch horror of H.P. Lovecraft stuff. And you're going to see some of that stuff in Cosmic Star Heroine as well. It's just really fascinating to us the themes that you can work with. And Breath of Death was kind of making fun of it because the world the world was blown up and now zombies and skeletons and ghosts took over. But it's just really cool. It's just another part of science fiction, I guess, that's not explored as much as aliens and then on the other end, fantasy. So it's really appealing to us.
You know, I've been calling for years. We've been doing RP Grinders for 7 years. And from day one, I always, and even before I did RP Grinders, I always called for an RPG or a JRPG that would deal just with horror, a horror RPG. And, you know, when I saw Breath of Death and the kind of the premise of that and Cthulhu Saves the World, it didn't fulfill that need for that, but at least the thinking was there, you know, and not a lot of people really think about that. The closest game that I've ever come to that was a game called Nocturne. I don't know if you ever had a chance to play Nocturne, but
you mean the Shin Megami Tensei game?
Yeah.
I'm familiar with it.
But the fact that you guys even give a nod in that area is at least a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and, you know, I think there are some horror RPGs. They're just not common. I haven't played it. I know Robert has a game called Corpse Party. Maybe it's not really an RPG in the traditional sense, but I think that's a horror-esque game.
Yeah.
And then there was actually an RPG that came out for the NES many, many years ago called Sweet Home, I think. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. I have heard of that, yes.
Okay. I think that's kind of a horror... Resident Evil-ish RPG, and I've never played it. I know very little bit about it, but I'm curious to find out more. I don't think it was ever released in the United States. I'm not sure. Maybe it was.
I do know that a lot of the inspiration for Resident Evil came from that game.
Ah, okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, given, you know, the two games and some sort of their premises. Yeah.
All right. Cosmic Star Heroine. Eric, you had a couple questions about that. I'm going to let you ask your questions about that. And I'm sure I'll come up with 50 million questions, Bill.
Sure.
Eric.
Well, I think I'll skip my Kickstarter question because you kind of asked it earlier.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, other than the fact that, well, I just kind of know why you decided to go back to Kickstarter for this game specifically.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, our first Kickstarter Kickstarter campaign was, I call it the pre-Double Fine era.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When Double Fine happened, it sort of changed Kickstarter and made it viable as a funding platform for games. Because before then, before pre-Double Fine, when we did our Cthulhu Saves the World PC version Kickstarter, it would be a monumental success for a video game campaign to raise more than, you know, $5,000. That was, mm-hmm, like a huge success.
Yeah.
Seriously. And so our first one was very modest, and we just needed some funds, mostly to help Robert, you know, spend the time he needed and buy the certain software to port the game to PC. And I needed, you know, just a little bit to do the art assets for the new campaign and stuff like that. So that was the reasoning for that. Mm-hmm. For this new one, I mentioned it before. It's about kind of jumping ahead a little bit from where we would if we didn't do the Kickstarter campaign. So if we didn't kickstart Cosmic Star Heroine, we still would have made it. It just wouldn't be anything like the game that we want it to be. And so, mm-hmm, the Kickstarter gives us that opportunity. And it's all about being able to have the funds to essentially pay for music and then also give us the time we need to make it and use the software and the licenses we need to make it as well. So, you know, we would have done it. If we didn't do Kickstarter, it probably would have been similar in scope and quality to Rainslick 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have had this opportunity to jump ahead and improve everything and make it this RPG that we've wanted to make ever since we started. We just never had the resources or the opportunity to do it. And the Kickstarter gives us that chance.
So this is the game that you really wanted to do, the Cosmic
Star. Yeah, for a long, long time. We've always talked, and I don't mean necessarily the theme and the characters and stuff, although we love the theme and characters and we're excited about doing a, you know, espionage space RPG, but just the scope and the quality and the type of game and the way it works and looks and plays, it's something that we've never really had a, felt like we've had the chance to do. We've always felt like we've had to cut back so much, mm-hmm, just to get it done and get it out, you know, with our time and resources before. So this now is the time we're able to do it. And it's basically, Kickstarter was a big factor in that.
Was there ever any discussions, even going back to Breath of Death, of doing like DLC, anything like that? Like, you know, like I mentioned, you know, adding dungeons that you may have cut from the first product and maybe adding a DLC pack later. Was there ever any talk about that, or was that just out of the question?
No, we've always actually, we always think about ways that we feel like we can sort of re-inject excitement into our older games.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we also talk about different business models, like, you know, doing episodic stuff or not, you know, or not. And, you know, we don't really think that's necessarily always episodic. Game development is not a one-size-fit-all,
mm-hmm,
solution. But we wanted to do a huge, essentially, expansion pack for the PC version because it was coming to a new platform, and we wanted to give people reason to get excited about it that had already heard of it or had already played it before. And I think that was a big reason why it succeeded on Steam, is just because it wasn't just a port. It was a port with a whole huge new campaign to go with it.
Hmm.
And so we also did some DLC for free for Rainslick 3, you know, hoping to kind of remind people essentially that it's out there and to check it out if you hadn't. But we learned from that experience that if you do DLC, you got to make it in such a way that people hear about it and it's visible and they can find out about it. And I mean, that sounds obvious, but our problem with Rainslick 3's DLC is that it was free, so we deployed it automatically to everybody's version. So if you didn't have it day one, you would just, it would automatically be patched to your game on day two, and there was nothing to tell you that you just received a whole bunch of content. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if we do DLC again, you know, it'd be a thing like Cthulhu Saves World, where we have some opportunity to get some get the word out about the game, get people excited, and then add new content to reinforce that, give people another reason to talk about it. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. Supporting your game is important, and we'll always update our game to make sure that it's minimal bugs and issues like that. But if we do huge content updates, it really depends on the opportunities as they arise.
Yeah. Eric, you had some specific questions about Cosmic Star Heroine.
Yeah. Like what are some of them your main inspirations for this game? I noticed that mm-hmm. during the Kickstarter, it had mentions of, like, Chrono Trigger and Suikoden, mm-hmm. stuff like that. So how did those play into that, of the creation of the game?
So an obvious inspiration from Chrono Trigger is sort of the look of it, but also the way it controls and the way the battles work. And all of our previous games, you had either a random encounter on the map or you had an enemy encounter on the map, and it went to a separate battle screen. Mm-hmm. And you had the characters on one side and the enemies on the other. Or in the case of Breath of Death and Cthulhu, it was a first-person view. Mm-hmm. And that's how the battles were. In this game, you see you see the enemies and characters on the screen, on the maps, just like Chrono Trigger. And they're moving around, and they have little artificial intelligence of their own. And you can actually avoid certain ones if you're sneaky. Like, you get around them at crucial times. And, you know, they bounce around, or they go on a patrol and things like that. Personally, I love that because I think it gives a little extra element of strategy. The player can choose which battles he can choose to sneak around it or go in, you know, head mm-hmm. first. Whereas before, it was kind of like you either had a random encounter forced on you, or you had an enemy blocking the way that you couldn't avoid. And so that's a big inspiration. So is the battles that take place on the map, which adds an element of, you know, targeting spatially where the enemies are. So an area of effect spell might affect these two enemies next to each other instead of just these two enemies that happen to be lined up in the battle that we set up for the separate battle screen. So that's the Chrono Trigger influence. The Suikoden stuff comes in mostly with the base building and adding characters as support members to your team. You don't really collect big party members from the characters that you can recruit. Rather, you add them to your base, and they act as support characters. So you can go and see them in your base in certain instances, and they affect some of your passive abilities. And I think some of them grant new abilities if you equip them to your character or party. So that's a big part. The base building, there's going to be sort of a base. I won't spoil it in the game, and that comes from Suikoden as well. We also have a big Phantasy Star influence. I mean, it's called Cosmic Star Heroine, so it's almost like the name is kind of a vague reference to it.
The main character is also named Alyssa, which shares a name with Alice.
Yeah, Alyssa.
And the two Alices, actually.
Right. Alyssa is inspired by that. We always wanted to make a female character for this game. Mm-hmm. That came in as a Phantasy Star influence kind of later on, just as we were coming up kind of with her story and background and her kind of her look and stuff. And I mean, that's an obvious reference. A lot of the stuff from Phantasy Star is, Phantasy Star combines a lot of fantasy. It's almost like you're in space in the future and you crash land on a fantasy planet. And mm-hmm. now it's a fantasy game. Mm-hmm. We wanted a lot more of actual sci-fi in this rather than just fighting, you know, generic fantasy monsters in a fantasy setting. But so yeah,
you like more, set up more like Mass Effect then?
Yeah, a little bit, but Mass Effect has more of a almost like a Star Wars-y feel to it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This has more of like an 80s like 80s sci-fi dirty used, I guess, which is kind of what Star Wars was, but I want to say it's more like Blade Runner sci-fi right. in terms of the feel of it. And if you look at a lot of 80s stuff and 80s sci-fi comics,
Space Adventure Cobra be a better example, you think?
Which one?
Space Adventure Cobra.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
That's more 70s, but
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with that, but mm-hmm. I'm drawing a lot of inspiration, at least for the settings, from stuff like Blade Runner and things like that. And 80s sci-fi has this – it was kind of left in the past by movies and modern media, mm-hmm. but it's really quirky and it's really dingy if you go and watch some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really cool to – use that as an inspiration for this game because it's so quirky and weird. We had these strange ideas about what, you know, the 2000s would be like in the 80s. And so getting the, you know, kind of grabbing from that is kind of fun and interesting.
Mm. I just looking at this screen of the heroine, I can definitely see kind of the Blade Runner type look that you're going. And I'm sure we'll see way more of that in the game for sure.
I also kind of wanted to ask if there'd be, like, use of cutscenes like you'd see mm-hmm. in a game like Phantasy Star.
Yeah, that was another thing, actually, that, yeah, you reminded me. Because that...
the intro is amazing. It's like a basically an attract mode for an arcade game.
Right. And actually, yeah, that was definitely inspired by Phantasy Star 4's intro, which is a really neat one. It doesn't require a whole, you know, Phantasy Star 4 was a cartridge game, mm-hmm. and... sort of the stuff they did with cutscenes in Phantasy Star 4 are really cool, especially given that it was on just a regular Genesis cartridge. It wasn't a Sega CD game. But
I know that originally it was supposed to be a Mega CD game.
Robert mentioned that to me yesterday, actually, which is interesting. Chrono Trigger and Secret of Mana were also originally going to be for the Super Nintendo CD add-on, but then mm-hmm. they split it into the two separate games. I don't know if y'all knew that, but mm-hmm. It was going to be one game and on CD. But yeah, we really like certain presentation stuff they did with Phantasy Star, and we'd like to do that. And we'd also kind of like to do the cutscenes you see in some of the Sega CD style RPGs and their cutscenes. Like the Lunar games are really good for that. And a few others. We looked at a game called Cosmic Fantasy, I think it was called. I've never played it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost kind of like, oh, that's a similar theme as yours. Cosmic, you know, there's a female and a male heroine and hero, and it's an RPG. But I think that's a kind of a – I think that's more comedy.
Sorry for the edit there, folks. There was a problem with my editing or my sound software, but – got all that fixed. We're still talking Cosmic Star Heroine, and not the kind that you shoot in your arm, you know, the male protagonist.
Unless you wanted to be, huh?
Yeah, unless you wanted to be, which is will be fine by Bill, I'd say, you know.
Yeah, we picked that name because we were hoping it would make people kind of have a double take. I mean,
right.
It's silly. Having a catchy name for your game is, in our opinion, kind of important when you do indie development. So
yeah,
that's kind of the story behind that. So,
you know, we've been having this running joke on RP Grinders lately, speaking of that, of the way that Japanese role-playing games handle their names. There's usually like 10 names to their title, you know, like...
Right.
Cosmic Star Heroine, Precipice of Darkness, Episode 1-2, and then there's usually something else that follows that. Uh-huh. You know, it's pretty funny. It's just kind of a running gag.
Well, Breath of Death's full title was a gag on that, and so is the PC version of Cthulhu Saves the World,
mm-hmm.
which I don't even remember what was it. It was like Cthulhu Saves the World Extended Edition 2000 Super Hyper Turbo FPS, you know, or whatever, went on for 10 minutes. And it's making fun of that little silly trope just because, yeah, RPG, a lot of RPG series are like these long-running ones, and now they have these crazy titles, so.
You know, one question I forgot to ask you, Bill,
mm-hmm.
before we end the interview, I don't think we have much more other than...
I had one more question, too.
Sure.
Okay, Eric, go ahead with your question, man.
I just wanted to know... if we can expect this out by the end of the year, or if you have any plans for what's to do afterwards.
Well, we're still shooting for the end of the year. It's going to be a crunch, so we'll see. We also have the considerations of, like, marketing the game amidst the holiday releases. So the other challenge we might run into is how easy or difficult it is to get it fully running on the various platforms that we're supporting with Unity. So we're still expecting, we're entering an asset production mode is what I call it, where we've got all the systems that run the game working. And so mm-hmm. then we just go through and start just churning out the content. And so since we're just now getting into that, production will go a lot faster, at least from a can-you-physically-see-it perspective. Once the game is done and released, we do what we usually do, which is, A, support it, you know, fix bugs that weren't caught in bug testing, which always happens. Mm-hmm. Talk about the game as much as we can. Talk to fans as much as we can. Promote it as best we can. There's going to be, a big thing. Towards the end of the content production, before we, you know, do bug testing, and then after the game releases, we're going to be working really hard on the Kickstarter rewards. Especially stuff like the art book, which requires a whole bunch of stuff from the finished game. So I'll be putting that together as an example among, you know, the t-shirt and the poster and things like that. And Robert has some stuff on his plate for that too. So it's going to be pretty busy even after the game is out. I mean, the job doesn't end just when the game releases on day one. So we'll be pretty damn busy.
Yeah, you mentioned bugs in the game and stuff like that, which kind of ties into what I wanted to ask you before that I forgot. How do you handle criticism? Because I think that would probably be the hardest but also most rewarding part of your job, right? To hear gamer complaints and kind of use that as a springboard to the next.
Yeah, so criticism, like not just reviews, but also fan feedback. We see Twitter feedback. We see people talking about it on their blogs and stuff. You're right. That's definitely one of the hardest, but also one of the most rewarding things, because you definitely hear about your game outside of your own perspective. And when the game is out, people are way more, I want to say, honest about it. When a game is in production, they can always say, well, I really liked that. I didn't like this part so much. But maybe they'll change it before release. Or they'll say, I want to be really encouraging to the developer. You know, I'm not going to be too hard on them. When a game is out and a totally unbiased party's bought it or has played it, I mean, they're going to say their honest opinion. And so for us, it's a learning thing. We see whatever they say that they liked, we want to remember to emphasize in our next game. Anything they said they didn't like, we want to be sure to address in a fun way in our, you know, the game that comes out that we work on next. So it's really interesting and it's useful as a developer for that reason. But I'm not going to lie. I mean, when you hear a negative review, it also feels a little like a kick to the gut. You know, if someone says, this game sucks, it's so boring, why does everyone talk about it? Ugh, bad, ugly, boring, it's a grind. I'm kind of like, my heart hurts. You feel it too.
Right.
So I try very hard, and so does Robert, to read it from an objective, almost scientific perspective, so that we can get to the root of what people like and don't like and use that as motivation in our next game.
Yeah. That's the only way you can look at it.
You should.
I had a hard time with this show when we first started out with criticism, but I learned over the years not everybody's going to like your product. You know, you just do what you do if you're passionate about it, and if the majority of people like it, then you're probably in good shape. And that's definitely been the case with your games, for sure. I mean,
we're definitely very grateful to people that play our games, that try them and like them. And the most, you know, the most rewarding thing is hearing from people directly. Like, we'll get emails out of the blue saying, hey, I played your game, Cthulhu or Rain Slick or Breath of Death. And I just loved it. I had so much fun. It was a great little RPG. Just wanted to email you, say thanks and keep up the good work. We'll get that, you know, an email like that out of the blue. And it's really motivating. And that's, I think that's one of the best parts of the job. That and personally, I love seeing fan art. I just love it to death that people are so, they like our games enough that they want to make their own take on a character or something. And it's inspiring to them. So those are the two things that I love to see. And it's a huge motivator to do more and to keep going and making better and better games.
I'm still waiting for my email saying that, Bill, you know, that we're doing a good job and stuff. But if I keep trying another 7 years, I might get those. Bill, It's been an absolute pleasure. Was there anything that you wanted to plug before we ended the interview?
I'm thinking not really. You can follow our Steam curator list. We're doing one of those. It's just Zvoid Games on Steam. You can also follow us on Twitter. My Twitter username is @BillAtZvoid. That's @Bill_AT_Zvoid, Zeboid. We also have a Zvoid Games Twitter, and my partner Robert, you can find him on, if you look at the info for the Zvoid Games Twitter. We're also on Facebook. You can check us out there if you want to find out more. We post things randomly all the time, like screenshots and musings and stuff about game design and stuff like that too. So yeah, I mean that's really out. Keep an eye out for Cosmic Star Heroine. We're getting pretty far in development, so check cool. it out.
I believe Robert's Where Zompire.
Yes, that's him. He's Twitter. @WhereZompire. WereZompire.
Yeah. All right, Bill. Thank you very much for joining us on RP Grinders this fine Tuesday afternoon. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate it, and hope to have you and maybe Robert on again sometime soon when the game releases.
Sure, yeah, that would be fun. Definitely hit me up or hit both of us up by email or Twitter. And yeah, we'd love to do it when the game is done. It'll be a lot to talk about, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to get a hold of us about this interview, it's @RPGrinders on Twitter. And that's all the plugs that I got. So again, Bill, we really appreciate it. Eric, did you have anything that you wanted to add before we ended?
Nah, not really.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill.
Yeah, sure thing.